Welcome to The Milestone, a clinically validated month-by-month guide to your baby's growth and development. I'm Matt, a pediatric occupational therapist and one of your hosts.
And I'm Jen Johnson. I'm a mom to Vivi, who's two.
Thanks for joining us. Friendly reminder, this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions regarding a medical condition. Happy listening.
Dr. Kelly Sackard is completing her pediatrics training at Mass General Hospital for Children. She grew up in the Boston area and went to medical school at UMass Medical. She's wanted to be a pediatrician for as long as she can remember and is a self-proclaimed kid at heart. She also happens to be engaged to Tom, one of the co-founders at Rahu Baby, which is how she met Erica and myself. Watching kids grow up over the years is one of her favorite parts about being a pediatrician, but she knows that doctor's visits can be a source of anxiety for both kids and parents. She's hoping that a podcast like this can help alleviate some of those worries. Kelly, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on the podcast.
We also have Dr. Elizabeth Meyer, who goes by Ellie. Ellie is completing her family medicine training at Swedish First Hill in Seattle. She went to medical school at UMass with Kelly and Tom, actually. She chose to be a family doctor because it allows her to care for patients at all stages in life. She's trained to provide prenatal care, maternity care, deliver babies, and care for newborns. She enjoys bonding with families and hopes that she can add insight into the maternal and postpartum care cycle, while she can also educate families about newborn milestones on this very podcast. Ellie, thank you for being with us.
So excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So why did we choose to have you two talk about these specific episodes that you're on?
So newborn and well child visits happen at birth and then sometimes around 2 weeks, but also at month 1, 2, 4, 6, 9, and 12. So Ellie and I will be featured on a few of these episodes just to give you an idea of what to expect at your upcoming well child checks and hopefully to answer some common questions at each step of development.
And we are so, so lucky to have the two of you. And what I love and what the listeners will soon realize is that the two of you are like the yin and yang, where you together, you cover all the subjects, but come at it from a slightly different perspective, which is really, really neat. So Kelly, what should parents expect going into their 1 month checkup with their baby? What will this appointment look like?
Yeah, so I know we're starting with month one here, but this hopefully won't be the first time we're meeting baby. There usually is a visit, right after they go home from the hospital, and then maybe around the 2 week mark if your pediatrician wants that too. But we usually follow the same general format for all of the checkups, and then add in kind of specific topics based on the baby's age. So at the 1 month visit, we usually touch on parental well-being at that time. We talk about nutrition, and I do want to put in a little plug right now, because I think the feeding the baby at this appointment can be a big source of parental anxiety. And I do see a lot of parents that come in that feel like they need to keep track of like every feed, every poop, every pee, and there's tons of apps out there to help you keep track of these things. And I want you to just like, as a parent, pay attention to, you know, what's helpful for you, because I think the apps can be super helpful for some parents, but for some can be kind of a source of anxiety as well. So what we want to know as your pediatrician is basically like, is your baby having wet diapers? You know, we usually say like 6 to 8 a day. Are they stooling multiple times a day? And like, what issues are you running into with breast or formula feeding that we can help problem solve about? And then like the rest is our job. Like, we'll keep track of how baby's doing in terms of their growth and their feeding by looking at their weight and their hydration status. So don't feel like you need to come into this appointment knowing everything that's gone on in the past month, because you'll be really sleep deprived and we don't expect that from you at all.
I'm laughing because that is exactly what happened to me. I mean, Mike and I, the second day in the hospital, we were like, how are we going to manage all this? And then of course my husband immediately was like, let's get an app. So of course, then it was like, if something was missing from the app, it was like, oh my gosh, wait, did we really enter or did we not enter it? Or did she not eat enough? And it was helpful, but in some ways it did create like a very heightened sense of anxiety. So I think just people should be careful about that. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, definitely.
Agreed. In another one, Ellie, that we wanted to make sure we talked about was sleep, right?
Yeah, sleep is the other really stressful point at this age. I think this is true kind of throughout the whole first year, but newborns aren't born with a regular sleep-wake cycle that, you know, our bodies as adults know. And plus, you know, they're eating so much more frequently than we do, so they can't sleep the normal amount that we're used to. During the first month, cluster feeding is also really common multiple times. And so what I try to say to my new parent patients is try to rest when your baby sleeps. And I really try to avoid saying like sleep when your baby sleeps, because that puts more pressure on parents to, you know, like fall asleep at these random times when your baby is sleeping all throughout the day and night. But I try to recommend, you know, don't try to be productive. Don't try to do the cleaning or the laundry while your baby's napping. Try to put your phone down and get some quiet and at least let your brain kind of rest during that time. Mm-hmm. And then the other, you know, big sleep topic that's important that all doctors care a lot about is what we call safe sleep. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has great like handouts and online resources if you want to learn more about this yourself. But safe sleep practices are really important because they have been shown to decrease the rate of SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, which, you know, all parents and doctors are scared of. And so the safe sleep practices that we remind parents about are the back to sleep method. And that's kind of our little phrase. If you're exhausted and it's the middle of the night, just say to yourself, back to sleep. So that means place your baby on their back on a firm surface. And we want a nice firm mattress and sleep space until about a year at least. There shouldn't be any other bedding, bumper pads, or soft objects like stuffed animals in that sleeping space, just their, you know, nice firm area. And the AAP recommends that you share the room with your baby until at least 6 months, up to a year if you can, to really help out with safety. And this is a nice time to shout out the research I did in med school. It was all about safe sleep. And actually in Finland, they use these little containers called baby boxes, and they give every new parent this. It's an actual box with a little mattress in it to reinforce like what a safe sleep area should look like. So I recommend people Google if they're nerds like me. But Finland has like one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world because they really emphasize safe sleep. And so it shows that doing these practices that we talk about really make a difference with SIDS.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because in my previous role, I did a lot of work with First Candle, which does a lot to bring SIDS awareness. We'll put links in the description to the AAP sleep practices. But it's funny that you bring up Finland. So my brother-in-law is from Finland, and so my nephew's 4, and he was just shocked that we didn't like, you know, that they like they didn't get anything like a box. But there are many, it's really interesting because that box also comes with like clothes, appropriate clothes, and really helps support the families while also showing them what safe sleep looks like. And it scares me sometimes because I do see a lot of products on the market that are very plush and you see people, I mean, like we all saw with those elevated sleepers recalls last year. I'm not, you know, mentioning any names because there was plenty of those products on the market of all brands, but you know, parents, when they get desperate, they think that it's okay, but it's really not okay. And so I'm so happy to hear you reinforcing that.
I agree. And actually on our website, we, in our little FAQ page, going back when we designed it, like over a year ago, I put in this little bit about if parents are reading, like it was first and foremost, the Rahu Baby Learning Lounge isn't to be used for sleep. But if you do have questions about safe sleep practices, feel free to reach out. And I didn't think anyone would, but I have like at least four or five people, potential customers, parents reach out every week asking about what products are best. And I always respond the same way. I'm not going to name the company right here. Yeah, who they don't need a free plug, but maybe we'll send a link. Actually, we'll put a link attached to this episode. But it's just what you're describing. It's just so simple. It's a little basket with a mattress in it, and it's the simplicity of it. Now it's expensive, so I always say, like, keep in mind you don't have to buy this. But there's so much contradictory like information when you open up your Instagram account and see all the things, different ways that babies are sleeping. So yeah. I think that's probably one of those things where you as a pediatrician, it's an example where you could say something over and over and over again, or like stamp it on the back of a parent's hand, but like it has to be reinforced. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And then just a total side note, you guys are so cool. I'm so impressed. We're like friends, so I never get to like see you act like doctors. And so it's just like, I'm just like, you guys know so much. It's like I never get to actually see you like where or Tom for that matter, just like being doctors. So it's like so cool for me.
Well, it's cool for us to see you as a businessman.
Yeah, as a businessman, maybe eventually. But so the other thing that we wanted to make sure we talked about, Kelly, was colic, which is just a name or word that, like, I don't even have a baby, but it just, that word alone gives me, like, anxiety to hear. But that's generally happening around this age, right? And so are there different ways that you advise parents to help a baby soothe when they're experiencing colic?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I feel like this visit is really important for talking about that with parents. And I think parents also tend to have questions about, you know, like, what's causing this and how can I prevent it? And to be honest with you, we don't really know what's causing it. Mm. And it's not anything that the parent is doing, and it can be a really difficult time. And for whatever reason, it seems to peak around like the 3 to 6 week mark, and tends for most babies to be worse in the late afternoon or evening. We call that like the witching hour. And honestly, it can be totally normal, but very distressing.
And can you just talk about for a second, what is colic? Like, what will parents experience? How would you know if you had a colicky baby?
Yeah, I think what I think of it as is a baby who is fussy, crying, even like inconsolable at times, that isn't related to lack of sleep or lack of food, which are honestly the only two things that a baby really needs at this time. And I think because it's, you know, we don't know what's causing it, and because it can last for hours on end, that's probably what makes it most distressing.
I was just going to say, you know, with Vivian, my time to sleep at first was between 6 and 10 p.m. and Mike would have her, and then I would wake up and do feedings overnight, kind of, you know, and that was her witching hour. And so that's when she was just like, nobody said the word colic to me, but that's when she was like a maniac. But I didn't really know, because I was sleeping with my headphones in, like trying to get some desperate sleep, right? But, you know, Mike kind of went through it with her in a really big way. Yeah. And I didn't quite realize it until later. So I think, you know, as a personal experience with that witching hour, it's not fun.
Yeah. I think that's a good time to have dad shift with the baby then. Mm-hmm.
Get mom some rest. I don't know. He wasn't a huge fan of it, but
yeah.
But other soothing techniques, Kelly, or like when it comes time to do your best to soothe the baby?
Yeah, a lot of what we tell parents in terms of soothing techniques has to do with this concept that was promoted by Harvey Karp, who's a pediatrician and author of a very popular parenting book called The Happiest Baby on the Block. Mm. And his theory was that either, you know, babies are born 3 months too soon. And he says that because I think parents expect that their baby comes out and acts like a 3-month-old and they're smiling and happy and sleeping well. But what babies really need is this kind of virtual fourth trimester where we simulate the womb for them. And the way that we do that are the 5 S's. So the first one is swaddling. And swaddling is important for babies at this age just because their startle reflex is so strong. So swaddling them up in a blanket or a sleep sack can help recreate that snug environment and help babies with sleep. Knowing that, you know, babies shouldn't be swaddled all day. This is just when they're fussy and just during sleep. And if you have any questions about swaddling technique, you can definitely ask your pediatrician about that. The second S is side stomach. And he had observed that when babies were fussy, holding them on their side or on, you know, their stomach over your shoulder can help soothe them. And just as Ellie was talking about, just a reminder that babies should be on their back for sleep. This is more just when they're fussy. The third S is shushing. So when babies in the womb, the sound of blood flow that they hear is actually louder than a vacuum cleaner. So babies like the sound that their parents make when they're shushing, or like the sound of like a white noise machine is very soothing for them. The fourth S is swing. So I'm sure you've observed that babies love to be kind of rocked for comfort, just the same way that they're rocking around in mom's womb when she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then the fifth one is suck. So babies, they can't cry and suck at the same time, which is why things like pacifiers can be really soothing for them.
I was going to say, the moms are always so surprised by the shushing when I talk to them about it. And I try to remind them, like when I throw an ultrasound on them in their prenatal appointments and try to find baby's heart rate, you can hear that whooshing and it's loud over the Doppler machine. Like whenever I put that on, you know, it's like, what is that? I'm like, that's your blood flow. And so that sometimes reinforces to them. They're like, oh, wow. Yeah, that was loud. And that's what baby was hearing. Like, yeah, exactly. And
I've never thought about that.
I have neither. And then I'm like,
I do know.
I'm addicted to that sound till this day. Like, I can't sleep with a fan even still. But I didn't know that's what it was for baby. Why that was so interesting.
Well, there was one night when Vivian was absolutely inconsolable and Mike and I were both up with her and something spilled and he turned on the vacuum to vacuum it up and she stopped crying immediately. We were like, what? And then when he turned it off, immediately started crying again. We were like, wait, turn it back on. Turn the vacuum on for long stretches of time. I even had on YouTube, they have like hours of uninterrupted vacuum sounds that you can video.
That's awesome.
No joke.
If you think about it, I mean, Harvey Karp wasn't the first person to think of this. Like, we've been doing this since the beginning of time. And,
right.
You know, taking babies on car rides or putting them near the washing machine, vacuuming, exactly.
Totally. And a lot of that is probably trial and error, right? Seeing what your baby likes and doesn't like and responds to. And so you're still getting to know your baby, I imagine, during that, like, first month that you're talking about. But I've never thought of it that way either, that it's you need that another trimester where they're really coming to life. Because I always felt kind of bad because I would joke, I would say, like, your baby is just going to be a blob when I would work with them, because developmentally they would come to see a therapist and they would expect that your baby would be doing so much more. And I would be like, no, your baby's just a blob right now. And parents would kind of be like, maybe I shouldn't say it that way, but what I was trying to say is, like, you can't really expect much until they're about 3 months. So I've never heard of it like explained that way. So, and then Ellie, we're so lucky to have you here too, because you have a little bit of experience, right? Talking about just maternal health during this time period, which is so, so important. And probably one of those topics that can get overlooked because you're so concerned with the baby themselves. So I'd love to hear anything you have to say on that topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Being in family medicine, I'm taking care of moms and babies. And so it is one of my passions to see mom and baby in the postpartum period. And the first 12 weeks postpartum are actually called the fourth trimester for mom. And it's, you know, a lot of healing and a lot of physiologic changes happening in those first 3 months and really through the whole first year postpartum. The, like you were saying, Matt, the traditional time frame for your postpartum visit is if you, you know, had an uncomplicated vaginal delivery and didn't have other medical problems during your pregnancy, is traditionally around 6 weeks. And that is a really long time to wait to see your doctor when, you know, you're in your third trimester and you're presumably seeing your OB provider every week or every 2 weeks up until delivery. And so I try to really acknowledge to my patients, like, that's a big gap of time where you are shifting all of your focus onto baby. And it's really important that you're keeping yourself safe and healthy, or else you're not going to be able to best care for your new baby.
Totally.
So I try to really, you know, reiterate that before my patients leave the hospital or the birth center, like, please call your doctor if you have any concerns about your own health and well-being. And your pediatric provider, even if it's not a family doctor, who's your doctor, they should be screening you for depression, and you're seeing them really frequently, and they are a great resource to talk about any concerns, and they can point you in the right direction if you need more. Sure. And so I wanted to specifically talk about postpartum depression. I know it's hard to talk about and people don't like to hear about it, but it happens in up to 10% of women. And, you know, especially if you have underlying disorder, it's a lot, right? It's a lot of people.
And those are probably only the ones who actually, like, report it.
Who actually get diagnosed. Yeah.
And to get diagnosed.
Right. Wow. And so, you know, baby blues or postpartum blues is really common. And that is, you know, the feelings of tearfulness and exhaustion and sadness that kind of peaks at 5 days after you have your baby, but should resolve within 2 weeks. So if after 2 weeks, you're still having, you know, really intense irritability or not being able to bond with your baby or really concerning, you know, lack of appetite or not being able to sleep, you should really call your doctor. It's a medical condition. It's not something that's, you know, a reflection of your personality or your ability to parent. And we take it really, really seriously.
Okay, so that's a good rule of thumb to know, that it's like that 2 week window. Like, if you're still having these issues, you need to get help like right away.
Yeah. And specifically, okay, you know, if you have been treated for anxiety or depression in the past, and that doesn't mean with just medication, you know, if you have struggled with that before, mm-hmm, you are at higher risk and you, you know, need to be aware of that. And your doctor should be aware of that too. But it's something the partner, you know, you should be keeping an eye out for.
It's such a huge change, life change, and not only a physical experience of like growing a human and then delivering them out of your body, but hey, guess what? Also, now you're somebody's mommy, especially for like a first time mom or even a second time mom who now has another child that they maybe are not having sibling issues or they need more attention from mom. And like, it's very easy, as I think, especially as a woman, to feel like you're just spread too thin. You want to kind of like just, I think we're sort of trained as women, sorry, Matt, to to kind of like soldier through all of this and care for everybody because that's what you're supposed to do. But I had a midwife say to me when I left the hospital, she said, just a reminder when I was checking out, she's like, you're the mothership. And I was like, what? It felt like she was coming at me with this kind of hippie, whatever. Yeah. But she said, you're the mothership. And if something's wrong with the mothership, then everybody around cannot function and thrive. So you have to take care of yourself. And so her words really stayed with me after that. And it's something I think all new moms really need to try to internalize.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Ellie, do you feel like that? Do you feel like because you're, it's so important that the mothers feel comfortable coming to you and talking to you about that stuff, that part of what you're doing even before that takes place is just making sure that you're trying to build a good rapport with the family so that they feel open enough to have that conversation?
Yeah. And this is one of my, like, my favorite pieces of being able to continue to care for them, you know, before they're even pregnant, through their pregnancy and after, is hopefully you get to know each other and we've talked about these things. If it's somebody who I think might be higher risk or who has less support, things like that, I'll talk about it, you know, when they start their third trimester. Like, this is something that we're going to look forward to. This is something we're going to be looking for. And if they don't feel comfortable coming to their doctor, they can go to somebody else. And, you know, mm-hmm. I've had a few patients who their spouse calls me like, I'm concerned about this and this. What do you think? And we kind of make a plan from there.
Yeah, that's amazing. And the two of you clearly have such great personalities that and that's like a component of being a good pediatrician, I feel like, because I remember when I was my pediatrician growing up, he was a guy probably in his 50s or 60s, but every time I went, I remember he was always like, he was probably dog tired and like ready to go home, but he always seemed so excited to see me. And I remember being like, this guy loves me. Like I'm making his day by being here. You know what I mean? And in reality, he was probably just a really good pediatrician with a really good personality that was like made to do that job. But I just remember always feeling so comfortable around the guy and thinking that like I was his whole focus when I was with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he probably did love you. It's so exciting to see families over and over, and you know, you don't often see them in between the checkups, and to see what they look like and how much they've grown year is always so fun.
It's so fun.
I mean, it must be. And so those were really the talking points we wanted to make sure we covered for month one. And so,
Can we talk about something a little bit more off the cuff, but it just kind of came to my mind when you brought that up. It's hard for parents sometimes, especially a first timer, to pick a pediatrician or know what to do with that. And, you know, I think Mike and I went to some like open house with different practices, which was cool. Could you guys talk a little bit about, you know, what should parents do? How should they choose a pediatrician? Mm. Maybe Kelly, I don't know if you want to take that first.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of our patients find us through either word of mouth from other families that are seeing someone in the practice. We do have a lot of families that will come in before baby's even born and do a prenatal visit where, you know, your pediatrician will tell you how the practice runs and what their hours are and introduce you to the providers and the clinic itself. And another resource that I think can be super helpful is after your baby's born, when you're in the newborn nursery there, asking the doctors and nurses that come and see you if they have any recommendations, because they usually know which practices are accepting new patients and who, you know, are ones that families have liked that are in the area.
Cool. Okay. That's good advice.
Yeah. I would totally agree. I mean, I'm in Seattle right now. And so I think the practice is a little different than when I was living in Massachusetts, but, a lot of parents come into the hospital already having picked out the practice. And I see a lot of them kind of picking based on practice rather than one particular provider. And I think that just goes to show that, you know, a practice has partners that have similar outlooks, and then you feel comfortable, you know, calling the on-call person or if your doctor is out that day seeing somebody else. But yeah, I agree with everything Kelly said.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's when we had our, you know, lunch and learn with the physicians in that practice. I think one of the things that made me really like them is that even though you have a main doctor, they all work together as a team and they seemed all very much on the same page. And they said to us very clearly, if you don't want to get your child vaccinated, this is not the practice for you, because every child in this practice is going to be vaccinated. We might be able to work with you on the timing if there's some specific concern that is related to your specific situation, but you know, we vaccinate everybody. So then that made me feel really confident, like, okay, they're not, you know, they've really took a hard line on something that was important to me.
Oh, yeah.
The Milestone is brought to you by Rahu Baby. Visit us at rahubaby.com and use our special code for our podcast listeners. It's Milestone20 for 20% off your first purchase.
Starting from my own experience, it was like, you know, my milk came in pretty quickly, but Vivian definitely had a hard time latching, wasn't quite, you know, working. And I remember like that I stayed in the hospital a little bit longer because I ended up having a C-section, which I wasn't planning to. And the second day in the evening, she was screaming and crying and just red. We were like just inconsolable. And I remember Mike like picking up the phone to the nurse's station and being like, excuse me. Yes. My baby's very red and very angry. So and they came in and she's hungry. So then I ended up like supplementing her a little bit with formula. And so, I mean, it was fine. Like it turned out fine, but I do remember having that feeling like I'm failing. And that was the feeling that was kind of ongoing through the whole process.
Yeah.
Banging like, I don't know. So it is, I don't want to say it's a sensitive topic, but I know people have strong feelings about it. And it's, that's why it's so great to have an expert like Jen to really.
Absolutely. And I'll say that, and so I'll just introduce you first, Jen. So Jen is a pediatric speech language pathologist and a certified lactation consultant who specializes in feeding and swallowing. Jen also has her own private practice, which is called Growing Together, Pediatric Feeding and Speech Therapy. So Jen has extensive feeding and swallowing experience after working at Boston Children's Hospital for over 15 years. And currently she works part-time at Boston Medical Center and in early intervention. So she also has children. So this is a busy woman, and we're lucky to have her here. But yes, Jen, like you were just saying, feeding is just such a charged subject. Mm-hmm. And I will say that having worked in early intervention also, it was an area that I didn't fully appreciate how charged of an issue it was or how stressful an issue it was for so many parents. I mean, it makes sense. You get home from the hospital and you're just all of a sudden like, that is the most like primal thing you need to eat. So there's nothing, there's like arguably nothing more important than that in that first month. So I would love to just kind of like a big picture question, Jen, like what month you're home from your baby and you're just like, what is going through your mind? What do you want parents to remember just when they get home?
Yeah. And it even before you even get home, just in the hospital, like you said, Jen, at your experience, like the stress started before you even had this baby on your own at the house. And, you know, besides focusing nonstop on poop and pee, it's feeding that you're really worried about. You're either like prepping to breastfeed, prepping the bottles, prepping the formula, burping the baby, feeding the baby, settling the baby after the meal. It's like just, it's nonstop and it's all day long, all night long. And that's where I think a lot of the exhaustion comes in and the unknowns about like what is normal, what is abnormal when it comes to feeding. And, you know, there's a lot of opinions from family members and what your culture is that you bring to feeding. So I think it's so important before you even have a baby to start thinking about some of those expectations. And, you know, a lot depends on what kind of support you're going to have around you in the home. Do you have, parents there to support you or, you know, other family members like aunts and uncles? And, you know, it just depends on who's around and who's going to be giving you their opinions as well. So I guess to answer your question, Matt, my big piece of advice would just be, you know, give it a little bit of thought ahead of time, but be flexible going into the actual baby coming to you and be willing to make changes to the whole process because, you know, you might set out to breastfeed and that's like your number one goal, but there are things that happen that make that not possible. And you have to know that just feeding your baby, whether it's formula or breast milk, is the best thing for any baby. It's not one versus the other. It is just making sure your baby thrives, gains weight, is growing, and your pediatrician will be there to support you through that.
Yeah. That's so interesting to hear you say that because I was starting to think about it that way, listening to you talk, that if you can think about it in a healthy way ahead of time, that, you know, acknowledge the fact that you have some, not necessarily, maybe they are biases because that's the way that you were raised or that's the way you saw other parents feed their baby. It's healthy to, ahead of time, think to yourself, I have what I
think is going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think this is how I'm going to feed my baby versus the very real reality that it may not go down that way.
Right.
There shouldn't be any guilt around that. Mm-hmm. Or shame.
That goes for labor and delivery as well, because I definitely had ideas of like what I thought was going to happen. And then there was what actually happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's probably the hardest part of being a parent.
Yeah.
Because you want to have a plan, but you have to be willing to do a different plan
and stray from that. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of support out there. If you do come to a place where you're like, I don't know where we go from here. Just know that there are people, there's, you know, therapists or your pediatrician or, you know, other people in the community that are there to support you when you come to that place where you suddenly don't know what to do. But for feeding to go right, there's so many things that have to align. Just the way that a baby is born, you know, you're born being able to suck as early as 28 weeks, the suck reflex develops in utero. So babies are kind of born ready to suck, but then you have to have the whole like respiration and swallowing and sucking, and all of those have to be a really specific, well-coordinated system for things to go right. So,
it's a very complicated thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think especially for moms to hear that, because there is so much guilt, I think, sometimes around these topics. But if your baby isn't quite ready or doesn't have the coordination, mm-hmm. you know, maybe that's not going to be the best solution.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding, or, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Sure.
Jen, I love the last time we talked previously, you said you don't like when people say breastfeeding versus using a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a not the best way to think about it. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it really shouldn't be the dichotomy of breast versus bottle, because that sets it up as almost like you have to choose one or you have to choose the other. And for so many moms, and this was my own personal case, I ended up having to do both because, you know, you want your baby to grow and thrive and gain weight. That's number one. So if you can't meet that with breastfeeding, then know that bottle feeding is an option and you're giving your baby just as much nutrition and, you know, all the good things that come along with that by bottle feeding as well. Because, you know, feeding is the reason why feeding is a lot of speech language pathologists fall within the specialty of feeding. It's not just about the oral and mechanics of sucking and all that. It is a communication with your baby when you're feeding your baby. You know, you're looking at your baby, you're making eye contact, you're talking to them, they're hearing your soothing sounds and all that. So that whole experience is what brings you into the when you're doing a feeding with the baby. And that doesn't change whether you're breast or bottle feeding. You're still promoting all of those good developmental things with either breast or bottle. So yeah, definitely not breast versus, but a lot of times you're supplementing with the bottle and at the breast.
I've never thought about it that way, but that makes so much sense that it's communication the whole way through. So I guess going along with that, what are some of the nonverbal cues you can get from your baby during a feed or before feed?
Yeah. And that's where parents become so good at reading their baby's cues. And those are called feeding cues or even pre-feeding cues, because they're things you want to pick up on before the baby even starts to sit down or lay down there for a meal. So the baby will show you that they're hungry just by either licking their lips, maybe sometimes bringing their fists up to their mouth. Sometimes they'll kind of like turn their head to the side as if they're rooting a little bit, which is a reflex that babies are born with that sets them up to be able to suckle and then feed. Sometimes just opening and closing the mouth. Those are all signs that the baby's getting ready to feed. If you're waiting till the baby's crying to start the feeding, you've almost like missed all those cues and it's too late. And sometimes you have to like resettle the baby down to get them to have a nice calm feeding. So crying is almost like a late sign of hunger. Yeah. So try to look for some of those other things first.
Yeah, because you want your baby to be organized, right? Mm-hmm. It is the way I learned about thinking about it. And not just for feeding, you want them to be what we say, you know, their central nervous system to be organized during really anything, whether it's sitting down to play or, and part of the success in doing that is like you said, catching those earlier cues that say, like, don't miss this window. Like, now's the time to feed me.
Yeah.
And so you want to try to, you know, and the environment plays a huge role too, right? Making sure that you're not, you're limiting maybe some of the extraneous stimuli, maybe you'd say, around the room. Extra light might not be necessary. Mm-hmm. Extra noise in the background might not be necessary to get help your baby get into that organized state.
Yeah. And even like positioning at that point too, you're cutting out all those loud sounds and lights and things like that. But just the act of swaddling your baby just brings them to a more organized state. And, you know, for most babies, it does help to kind of settle and soothe them so that you can then get them in a good position so that they're comfortable feeding.
Can you guys go back and explain a little bit about being organized? What does that mean for an infant? Because, I mean, I would never have known that term if I didn't meet Matt and Erica.
Well, Jen, you have a lot more insight to offer than me, so I'll go first. But the way I had learned about it from some of my mentors is that if your baby is, we'll start with what's not organized, your baby can give you these other cues. Like, for example, I don't want a parent to hear this and think that every time their baby sneezes, it means that they're not organized, but there are these cues that a baby can give off to say that, basically my nervous system isn't calm or, it's not soothed enough that it is going to allow me to focus on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so from a feeding standpoint, Jen, I'll let you take it, but it's this really overwhelming challenge that we're asking your baby to master. It requires coordinating all these different systems of your body to be successful with it, which, as you can imagine, really requires them to be calm and soothed and focused.
I think you've described it really nicely. You know, and there's things that we would train parents to look for that show that your baby is not calm and organized. And those are things like your the eyebrows getting raised up or, you know, the fingers kind of splaying out, like really stress. We kind of see that more in babies that are born prematurely that still have their nervous system needs to kind of catch up with the fact that they were born early. But there are some signs that babies show you that they're kind of, it's almost like stress, and you want to, you want to, as the parent, try to reduce and cut out a lot of that stress so that you start the feeding off on a good, comfortable note for the baby.
Gosh, I wish I had you guys around.
I'm sure you did just fine.
Yeah.
I'm looking back at all these things and I'm like, oh, okay.
You learn from each baby that you have. You absolutely learn and take things from one to the next too. So
you know, I think that all the time. I'm like, okay, now I get it. Sorry, baby.
And so when it comes to bottle or breastfeeding, are there more like technical things that you want parents to remember for success? Nothing too nitty gritty. But like general positioning or anything.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about swaddling. That's a good place to start. Positioning is going to vary from one baby to the next, but the options for bottle feeding are usually either like side lying or just very slightly inclined, almost like a cradle position. And I know like the Rahu baby, actually, I saw some pictures of how you are able to kind of bring the baby to a central position and, you know, really support them so that they're nice and organized from a physiological standpoint so that you get them, you know, nice and calm, have good breath support so that they can have that suck, swallow, breathe either at the breast or the bottle. As far as equipment and stuff like that, it's nice to you can go into any baby store and be totally overwhelmed by the number of bottles and nipples, and it is crazy. And every time I go in, there's a new brand of bottle out there. And a lot of them are so confusing because they say just like the breast on them, but there is no baby bottle that you will ever be able to buy that is going to mimic what happens at the breast. Mm. What's so beautiful about breastfeeding is that your body is equipped to be able to let the baby suck and control the flow of how quickly the milk comes out in general. There are some issues with that, which, you know, as a lactation counselor, I can support and, you know, show you how to slow things down if we need to. But it's, you know, you hear a lot about nipple confusion and not wanting to, like, don't introduce a pacifier, you're going to confuse the baby, or, you know, don't switch bottles around, you're going to confuse the baby. It's not that the nipple is confusing the baby, it's the flow rate of these bottles that's confusing the baby. Okay. So what we generally recommend starting with is a very slow flow bottle. As a speech pathologist, what we use a lot is are the Dr. Brown bottles, because they do have a lot of different options for very, very like ultra slow bottle that then progresses up as the baby grows. So you might start with like a preemie flow or a newborn flow. And then as the baby grows, you go to level 1, 2, 3, 4. So you can kind of like support them throughout their whole feeding journey when it comes to bottle feeding. But there's a lot of really good bottles out there, and I think just finding the right flow rate and knowing what to look for so that you know what's not a good flow rate, like coughing or babies like sputtering or showing some of those stress signs, like the eyebrows going up, or, you know, gurgling or losing liquid out the side of their mouth. Those are all signs that something's not quite right. And that's when to either reach out to a feeding specialist, or even, you know, your pediatrician can probably set you up with somebody to kind of take a look at what the what's going on during the feeding and support you.
Cool. Yeah, I remember that with when Vivian was a little bit older, we didn't really understand that, you know, I would pump and she would go to daycare. And I remember the daycare calling me one day and say, you know what, I think you need to go to the next flow to pull the bottles, because this kid's getting really angry.
Yeah. They're starting to collapse the nipple when they get too strong. Yeah, that happens too.
I'd also love to ask about tongue ties. It's not something that, you know, we can go into too much detail with, because it would certainly require a discussion with a pediatrician or with someone like yourself. But first of all, how common do you feel like those are? And then what are some signs that that may be the case?
Yeah. So I feel like they're, I don't know if they're more common nowadays, but I know that the specialists that assess for tongue ties are more aware of them in recent years. I feel like it's become a bigger thing, probably because there's been such a push by the, you know, the World Health Organization to promote breastfeeding. And with that comes a lot of parents who then struggle to breastfeed, and you then look for answers for why is this an issue? Why can't I breastfeed? Why can't the baby latch? And if you're not finding something with the mother's breast, then you start to also make sure you do a full assessment of the baby's mouth and suck pattern. And with that evaluation, we are seeing more tongue ties. So it's not that they're occurring more frequently. I think we're just better at assessing them now. And if you do see them, it is a little bit of a controversial topic, especially in our speech pathology world, because you don't always need to clip the tongue tie if the baby is functionally able to eat. So, you know, it's, you just want to make sure you have somebody that's had experience with this and comfortable assessing for tongue tie. And then you can either see a pediatric ENT or a pediatric dentist that has specialty in dealing with tongue ties. Not just tongue ties, but like lip ties. There's a whole, you know, complicated world there.
I've definitely seen a lot of people on social saying that their child has tongue tie, or they think they suspect this or that. And, you know, you just, like you said, it's so important to get someone who's an actual expert in this and not just try to diagnose things yourself, because, you know, what we think could be a tongue tie probably is not a tongue tie. And because there is so much more awareness of that topic, I think sometimes as soon as a mom has a problem with feeding, then it's like, oh, it must be a tongue tie. Well, maybe, but maybe it's something else.
Yeah. And there's a lot of research coming out around assessment and whether we're over-diagnosing and treating tongue ties. And what the research that I like to refer to from MGH showed that with an evaluation by a feeding specialist or a lactation consultant, they were able to reduce the number of tongue tie surgeries that they were doing. So it does take the evaluation of somebody with some skill set in this area to try to prevent an unnecessary procedure or surgery.
Absolutely. A classic example of loop in those therapists when it's necessary, right?
For sure, yeah.